Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
It is May the 9th, and we are beginning Parshas Matos. We are on page 900. Vayaver Moshe el Roshei HaMatos livnei Yisrael leimor. Moshe spoke to the heads of the Matos, the heads of the tribes of the Bnei Yisrael, saying, Ze hadavar asher tziva Hashem. This is the thing that Hashem commanded. The phrase Roshei HaMatos, the heads of the Matos, is only found here. This is the one time that the Torah uses that phrase, that Moshe spoke to the heads of the Matos, and therefore, of course, we want to understand why is it stated over here. The simple meaning would be that Moshe said the following set of laws only to the heads of the Matos. That's what it sounds like in the Torah. That sounds like the phrase is saying. He didn't speak to all the people. He only spoke to the heads of the Matos. However, Chazal prove that that is not the case, that he actually spoke to everybody, just like the rest of the Torah. So then why does it say Roshei HaMatos? So that's because Chazal tell us that in this particular set of laws that we're about to read, the heads of the Matos have a particular, not a particular role to play, but more of a, they have an exclusive power. It's an exclusive power that they have regarding the following set of laws. Now, what set of laws are we talking about? We can't discuss what that exclusive power is till we know what the law is. So the laws we're about to discuss are the laws of taking a neder, taking an oath, a vow. Meaning that the Torah has already discussed a person who takes a shavua. A shavua is also an oath or a vow. And we have different types of shavua. A shavua could be one takes an oath that something happened or didn't happen. I swear that I ate breakfast. I swear I didn't eat breakfast. Those would both be examples of shavua. They're both concerning something that I did or did not do, or something that happened or did not happen. One could also take a shavua about the future. I swear that I will eat breakfast. I swear that I won't eat breakfast. Those are also types of shavuas. So a shavua could be both past and future. At least there's different opinions, but I'm going with the mainstream opinion. A shavua can be both past and future, and a shavua could be both in the positive and in the negative. But here we're introduced to neder. What is a neder? A neder, which is another word for an oath or vow, but a neder is the process of making something which is mundane, but to give it laws. So one can make a neder that this bottle of water will be prohibited. That's different than saying, I swear I won't drink the bottle of water. If I swear I won't drink the bottle of water, I'm not talking about the bottle of water, I'm talking about me. I won't drink the bottle of water. A neder, the Ran explains, is this bottle of water should become prohibited. That's a neder. A neder is focusing on the object and it's prohibiting the object. I can prohibit any object to me, meaning I can make myself prohibited. I can say this bottle of water should be prohibited to me, and I can say that chair over there should be prohibited to me, even if it's not my chair. I can also prohibit any of you if it's my bottle of water. I can say this bottle of water should be prohibited to you with a neder. So I can, as long as I own it, I can make it prohibited to any of you using this system of neder. I can't make an item that I don't own prohibited to someone other than me. So I can't say that that chair, which I don't own, should be prohibited to all of you. That won't work. So again, I can prohibit any item to me, even if I don't own it, I can prohibit it to me. And I can prohibit anything I own to anybody. But I can't prohibit something I don't own to anybody other than me. And that's the way a nether is going to work. A nether is object focused. So you can use nether as a form of social separation. I can take a nether that everything I own should be prohibited to you. That would in effect keep you away from me. Because if you interact with me, you may end up using or benefiting from things that I own. I could also say everything you own should be prohibited to me. That's another way of social separation that could be done with a nether. And the Gemara routinely speaks about cases of someone who is mudur hanam echavero, someone who is the object of a nether, or not the object of a nether, but that he is the person about whom the nether is directed, and he is therefore prohibited to another person, either because he prohibited himself to the objects of the other person, or the other person prohibited that person to his objects. The Gemara routinely speaks about these things and discusses what would be permitted and what would not be permitted under those circumstances. What happens if, for example, someone takes a nether prohibiting a person to derive benefit from everything they own, and then there's a need for the things that they own? What happens if the things I own I prohibit to everybody, and then I donate what I own to the shul? So can people derive benefit from it? There's all kinds of cases like that.
Well, you don't own it anymore.
Right? So you could suggest that since I don't own it anymore, therefore the nether disappears. Or perhaps once it has that nether, it sticks with it. Right. So there's all kinds of cases that the Gemara discusses of this sort of thing.
Can an object be a person? Like, can you say, I'm prohibiting my daughter from...
Right. Okay, good question. So the question is, can an object be a person? Can I prohibit a person or me? Just the person themselves. So the Gemara discusses how that can be done. It's a little tricky, but there is a way of making that happen.
And it's still considered a nether.
Yeah. So there's the laws are complex. The laws are relevant today because a person can take a nether today. A nether does have legal standing.
Because we always say b'li nether.
Right. We say b'li nether. Good. Good. We'll discuss that in a minute about b'li nether. But we talked about b'li nether when we talked about Shavua, but we'll review that now, Mir Sashem. The b'li nether. We'll review that. So a nether therefore essentially adds to the Torah. That's really what it is. The Torah has objects that are prohibited to us and objects that are permitted to us, and then a nether can take an object that is permitted and make it prohibited. The truth is a shavua also is essentially adding to the Torah. The Torah has things that we must do and must not do. And a shvua can require me to do things that I wasn't planning, that the Torah doesn't force me to do, and it could prohibit things that otherwise the Torah would have permitted. So all the Torah acknowledges that one's speech can make binding laws, which is a fascinating idea, because the laws come from Hashem, so that my speech can then create a binding law. Now, of course, it's not really my speech creating the binding law. It's the law of Hashem that my speech will be binding. So it's still coming from Hashem. But still, it's a fascinating thing that the power of adding laws was given to human beings. We can add on laws. Now, we can't add on, as I said before, I can't prohibit you to what I don't own. And I can't take a shvuah that you will do something. I can only take a shvuah that I will do something. But still, when you see the power that a person has, we know that we give a lot of weight to this power, and that's why the very first thing we do before Yom Kippur, as Yom Kippur is starting, is Kol Nidre. Kol Nidre, that's the word neder right there. And we annul our oaths and our vows with Kol Nidre. We're acknowledging with Kol Nidre the power of a person's speech. And we therefore, we take it very seriously, and we annul our vows prior to Yom Kippur. So, the fact that the phrase Rashi Hamatos appears here, the heads of the tribes, tells us that the heads of the tribes have a particular power that is not granted to other people. So what is that power? So we're going to see that the primary focus of the next, basically this paragraph that we've started, is not so much what is binding, but rather how to annul a vow. If one took a vow, how do you remove it? That's going to be the main focus. So the Rashi Hamatos are going to have a particular power in annulling vows that others don't have. So we'll see that as we move along over here. So let's move a little further. Pasuk Gimel, verse 3. Ish ki yudar neder la Hashem, a man who shall take an oath to Hashem, o he shava shvua, or he takes a shvua. So both are mentioned over here. Les or isar al nafsho, to prohibit a prohibition upon himself. Lo yachel divaro, he shall not make his words mundane. He shall take his words seriously. Whatever comes out of his mouth, he shall do. So the Torah tells us you have to keep your word. If you say it as a neder or a shvua, you have to keep your word. The way the Torah says this is, don't make your words mundane. Treat your words as if they're sanctified. One could argue, I mean, it's just words. What is it? It's just it's nothing. No. Torah says, treat it as if it's sanctified, because it is. If you say it with a neder or a shvua. If a person just says, tomorrow I will eat breakfast, that is not binding, because he did not say it with a neder or a shvua. But if a person says, I swear that tomorrow I'll eat breakfast, even using an English term for shvua or neder, that is binding. And so, the Torah says, don't treat it like it is mundane, rather treat it like it has sanctity, and it is binding. The mechanics of how a neder works is that we know there are other things that happen through the speech of a person. For example, let's say I have a pile of grain in front of me that was grown in Eretz Yisrael. So I need to give a certain amount to the Kohen, a certain amount to the Levi, a certain amount to the poor person, there's certain things I have to do. It's all a bunch of grain over here. So I want to take some of it off and give it to the Kohen. But I don't just take some of it off and give it to the Kohen. I take some of it off and I say, this grain is Truma. And then I give that to the Kohen. By saying this grain is Truma, I have actually given a legal status to the grain that I proclaimed as Truma. My mouth gave status to that grain. You know this from Hafrashas Challah. You do the same thing when you separate challah. You pull off some dough and you say, Hare zu challah. This is challah. So the just the words make it challah. It gives it a, what we call in Hebrew, a chalos, which means that it gives it a legal standing. It gives it a legal status, let's say that, a legal title. And it is binding. So this is true with truma, it's true with challah. It's also true with hekdesh. If I say that this item is Hekdesh, then this item is now owned by the Beis HaMikdash. And no one can derive benefit from it. Because if it's owned by the Beis HaMikdash, it's off limits. If I give a status of Hekdesh to an item, it becomes sanctified and it is now owned by the Beis HaMikdash and it's off limits to regular people. When I take a neder and I say this item should be prohibited to me with a neder, the mechanic is that this item should be prohibited to me as if it is Hekdesh. As if it is owned by the Beis HaMikdash. Now, it's not the same thing as saying this item should go to the Beis HaMikdash, because by saying that, it's prohibited to everybody, not just to me, because now I don't own it anymore. It's owned by the Beis HaMikdash. When I say this item should be prohibited to me as if it is Hekdesh, as if it's owned by the Beis HaMikdash, the item is still owned by me. And I'm the only one who's prohibited to it, nobody else. So it's not actually taking this item and giving it to the Beis HaMikdash, but it is using the paradigm of Hekdesh, of something owned by the Beis HaMikdash, which comes about through my words. Only my words gives it a certain legal status. That's how it works. So the Torah says, if you do that, you need to keep your word. What about Bli Neder? So Bli Neder says that my words should not be binding. I'm explicitly saying I don't want my words to be binding. So I don't want to be held to what I'm saying. The question is, why do you need to say Bli Neder? If I never said that it should be a neder, I never took a vow, then why do I have to say without a vow? Meaning, what's the status of a simple statement where I don't mention the word vow? I don't say with a vow, I don't say without a vow. I just say, this should be prohibited to me. What is that? Is it binding or not binding? The answer is, it's not binding. So then why do I need to say Bli Neder without a vow? If I say a vow, then it's binding. If I don't say a vow, it's not binding. So why do I have to say Bli Neder? The answer to that is that normally your words are not binding if you don't say a language of neder or shvuah or oath or promise or something like that. However, if it is a devar mitzvah, if it is something to do with a mitzvah, then words are binding, even without the word neder or shvuah. So if a person gets up and says that tomorrow I am going to do a particular chesed, so that's a mitzvah. And therefore their words are binding. And that is where one is advised to say Bli Neder. Or Bli Shvuah would also be acceptable in that case.
Isn't it more acceptable?
Yeah, Bli Shvuah would be the more appropriate phrase. Okay. But either one works. Bli Neder or Bli Shvuah would both work. To say that I don't mean my words to be binding. And any time a person says anything that they're planning on doing that is mitzvah related, that's where you want to say Bli Neder or Bli Shvuah. And that way, it's not binding. And you want to do it because if one says they're going to do it and it's binding through a neder or a shvuah, and then they don't do it, then the consequences are bad. So we don't want to be stuck with a neder or a shvuah. So if a person says that tomorrow I'm going to do a particular chesed, or if a person says tomorrow I will not speak Lashon Hara. Well, no question, a person should not speak Lashon Hara. But if he says, tomorrow I will not speak Lashon Hara, he should say Bli Neder or Bli Shvuah. So in order that it not also have the legal standing of a Neder or a Shvuah. And that's because it's a mitzvah, a Devar mitzvah. The case of the Gemara is a case where a person says, tomorrow I will learn a particular section of Torah. That's a mitzvah. So a person therefore should say, Bli Neder. Then I'm not trying to bind myself with it. Otherwise, it's not necessary. Even though the Torah says, Midvar Sheker Tirchak, you have to stay away from lies, but a lie is not binding. It's wrong to lie. If a person says that A person says, yesterday I ate breakfast and he didn't. That's a lie. And it's not good that he lied, but it's not a neder or a shvuah, because he didn't take a neder or a shvuah, and it's not a dvar mitzvah, it's not a type of mitzvah. But if a person says something with a mitzvah involved, then it would be binding through neder or shvuah.
Question.
Yeah.
How is this not adding
So the question is, how is this not adding to the Torah? And the answer is, it is adding to the Torah, but this is a sanctioned adding to the Torah.
Okay.
Right. So it is something the Torah told us that we can add in this way. The question really is, and I think you really are asking this, is it a good idea? Right? I mean,
is there a line that we
right.
should cross?
Is there a line that we shouldn't cross? Right. Baruch Torah, so I'm going to ask you to hold the place here on page 900 and turn ahead to Megillas Koheles, of all places. And we are going to go to page 1282 in Koheles, Perek Hei, chapter 5. Perakeh chapter 5, Pasuk Gimel verse 3 in Koheles. Kasher tidor neder lelokim. When you take an oath to Hashem, al te'acher l'shalamo, do not delay to pay it. Here we're talking about a person who takes a neder. For instance, they say this animal should be a karban, or more like a shvua, I'm going to give a certain amount of money to tzedakah. Ki ein chefetz bakisilim, because there is no value to fools, meaning a fool that says they're going to do things and don't do it. Eis asher tidor shalem. Whatever you vow, you should make sure to pay. Make sure you follow through. But look at the next pasuk dal, verse 4. Tov asher lo sidor. It is better not to take an oath, Misha Tidor, rather than take an oath, Velos Hashalim, and not pay. Best you don't take an oath, rather than take an oath, and risk not paying. The Gemara says, okay, but what about if you take an oath and pay? You do it. You follow through. Which is better? Is it better not to have taken an oath at all? Or is it better to take an oath and actually follow through? This is a machlokas in the Gemara. But the conclusion seems to be that it is best not to take a neder. Under most circumstances, it is best not to, and rather to simply do what one is supposed to do without the additional factor of a neder. There are situations where a neder is called for. One situation, the Ramban writes, is be'es tzara, when it's a time of danger, and a person is in a situation like Yaakov Avinu was in, where he was afraid about love and he was afraid about Esav, and he said to Hashem, whatever you give me, I will tithe, aser asrenu lach, in the beginning of Parashas Vayetze, he took an oath, Hashem, if you bring me back safely, I will tithe my things, I'll give it a miser. So he took an oath. So that oath is warranted, says the Ramban. Because since it is an Eis Tzara, sorry, give me a minute here. Since it is an Eis Tzara, therefore it has value. Okay, we're trying one second. Not letting me. But a person needs to, when a person is in an Eis Tzara, it's a time of danger, then there is room to take an oath, even though normally we say not to. Yeah.
How about, Hannah, when she was davening for a child and she said, if I have a child, I'll
do it. Right. So how about
Tzara?
Right. How about Hannah? So that's not technically Tzara, but it is similar. meaning that she was in a place where she really needed something, and then she took this oath. The other times that an oath could be warranted would be if a person is trying to grow in a certain way and is having trouble controlling themselves, so they take an oath as an added boost to make sure that they will be careful. Now, that one has to be very, very careful with doing that, because it's so easy to take an oath and then not follow through, especially if it's something a person is having trouble with self-control about. But I do know a couple of different people who have taken oaths of that nature and have followed through. But you have to know yourself, and generally we discourage it, as the chance of getting in trouble is very high. So let's go back now to page 900. Pasuk Dalet, verse 4. V'isha ki sidar neder la Hashem. A woman who takes a neder to Hashem, v'asra isar b'vei saviyah binu reha, and she prohibited something in her father's house when she was a na'ara. A na'ara is a young woman. What age is that? Na'ara. So the na'ara is not yet an adult. However, it's not a ketana. It's not a little girl. So the Gemara tells us as follows. If she is already 12 and a half or older, then she is older than na'ara. She is no longer considered to be bound to her father in her father's house, even though she's maybe living at home, but she is already beyond that age. If she is under the age of 11, then she is a ketana. She's young, she's a little girl. If she is between 12, which is bas mitzvah, and 12 and a half, she is a na'ara. Then it would fit this age, na'ara. If she is between 11 and 12, then it depends. If she understands what she's doing when she takes an oath, then she would be in the category of na'ara. If she does not understand what she's doing when she takes an oath, when she's between 11 and 12, then she would not be in the category of na'ara. So again, under 11 is a ketana, is a young girl, and her oaths are irrelevant. It's just babbling. It doesn't mean anything. It has no legal standing. If she's above 12 and a half, she's already exited her father's domain, and her oaths will not be relevant to what we're about to discuss. If she's between 12 and 12 and a half, that is a na'ara, and that is the exact age that we're discussing over here, and between 11 and 12 will depend on the particular young lady. Depends on whether she understands or doesn't understand what is going on. So, what is the rule about a na'ara who takes an oath? Pasuk Hey, verse 5. V'shama avia es nidra, her father will hear her oath. V'es sara asher asra al nafsha, and the prohibition that she prohibited upon her soul. V'hekarish la avia, and her father is quiet. If he hears about it and he is quiet, then v'kamu kol nidareha, then all of her oaths will become established. V'chol yisar asher asra al nafsha yakum, and all of the prohibitions that she prohibited upon herself will also be established. So if he hears about it and he is quiet, then the oath has legal standing. But, Pasuk Vav, verse 6, Vim heini aviha osa biyom shamo, if her father prevents her on the day that he hears about the oath, then kol nidareha ve'esareha, all of her oaths, all of her prohibitions, asha asra al nafsha, that she prohibited on her soul, lo yakum, they will not be established. V'Hashem yislach la, Hashem will forgive her, ki heini aviha hosa, because her father has prevented her, or it says in the English, restrained her, has prevented her from taking an oath. The father of a na'ara has the power to nullify her oaths. That is a unique power that a father has. It only is with a young girl, but only this age that we're talking about, between the age of 12 and 12 and a half, and possibly between 11 and 12, depending on the type of girl, on how much she understands. And he is able to nullify her oaths. The Gemara explains to us, this is why the term Roshei HaMatos is used in the beginning of this parasha. Because we have the concept of nullifying oaths and vows for any oath and vow. One can go to a Talmud Chacham, one can go to a Torah scholar, and a Torah scholar can nullify oaths and vows. Just as a father can nullify the oaths and vows of a Na'ara, so too a Torah scholar can nullify the oaths and vows of anybody. Anybody's oaths and vows. However, this rule that a Torah scholar can do it is only if he is a standout, if he's a superior Torah scholar. A regular run-of-the-mill Talmud Chacham would not be able to remove an oath or a vow on his own. To do that, you would need a Beis Din. You need three. And most people, even accomplished Talmidei Chacham, accomplished Torah scholars, are not in the category of Roshei HaMatos, are not in the category of being the heads of the tribes. They're not in that lofty level of scholarship. And therefore, they would need to have two others with them in order to nullify a vow. They would not be able to do it on their own. But that is why the phrase Roshei HaMatos is used, is to explain that it can be nullified by a single person if he is a standout Torah scholar, standout Talmud Chacham. This process of a three-person based in removing an oath or a vow, we also do on Erev Rosh Hashanah. On Erev Rosh Hashanah, it is a minhag that after davening, the men get together and they get into groups really of four, and one speaks to the other three and asks that his vows get nullified, and they say, Mutulach, 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 it's nullified. And then he sits down among the four of them, one of the other ones gets up, and now he's the one asking of the three. And they do a round robin till all four have accomplished it. That's a common minhag that takes place on Erev Rosh Hashanah. Most women have never seen it because they're not in shul on Erev Rosh Hashanah. But it is a common thing that is done on Erev Rosh Hashanah to remove oaths and vows. This process of removal is similar to the process of a father removing the oaths and vows of his daughter. But there is a major difference. There is a major difference. There's actually several major differences, but it revolves around the same difference, which is this. When a father removes an oath or a vow, it is mikan ulahaba. It is from here on, which means that the vow may have been binding until this point. The father hears about it, and then he says, Mufar, it is nullified, then it is nullified from here on. But it was in force until this point. The father does not need to justify the removal of the vow. He could just say, I remove it. But with a Talmud Chacham, with a Torah scholar, whether it is the single Torah scholar or it's the three that are removing an oath or a vow, it is removed retroactively. What they are saying is, this vow never had any power, never had any legal standing. Retroactively, it is removed. And it requires an excuse. It can't just be removed. It requires a Pesach or a Charata. A Pesach means a doorway, which means there's something that was figured out, some loophole that was considered that removes it. Or Charata. Charata means one is regrets ever having taken the vow. So what is the difference between Pesach and Charata? This is the classic case, which I announce every Erev Rosh Hashanah in order that everybody should understand the difference, that a person takes a shvua that they will go to the mikvah every day. A person takes such a shvua They say, I'm going to go to the mikvah every single day. And they begin doing it, and then the water is really cold. And they no longer want to keep doing it. So they go to the Talmud Chacham or to three in order to remove it. So a Pesach would be that he didn't realize that the water was cold. The water was cold, but he didn't understand, he didn't know that. He thought the water was tolerable. He didn't realize how cold the water was. That's a Pesach. It's a piece of information that had he known it, he would not have taken the vow, but he didn't know that piece of information. A Charata is, he knows how cold it is, and he thought he'd be able to handle it, and now he regrets ever having done it, now that he realizes he can't do it anymore. So one is a Pesach, one is a Charata. But a father doesn't need those excuses. He can remove the vow simply because he says so. The Gemara Maseches Kedushin asks the question, why does it say at the end of Pasuk Vav, verse 6, V'Hashem Yislach La, Hashem will forgive her, for her father has prevented her vow. What forgiveness is needed over here? If her father has removed the vow, then there's no vow anymore. So what exactly is being forgiven? What case are we talking about over here? So the Gemara says, we are discussing a case where a father removed the vow, but his daughter doesn't know. And she then transgresses what she thinks is a vow, even though it's not. So she took a vow that she will not eat ice cream. Father heard about that and decided that's not a good idea. I know my daughter. She's going to eat ice cream. So he removes the vow, but she doesn't know that he removed the vow. And then she goes and eats ice cream, thinking that she is violating the vow. Says the Torah, "Hashem yislach la." Hashem will forgive her. She needs forgiveness. The Gemara says that when a person thinks they're doing an Avera, even if they didn't do an Avera, forgiveness is needed. The Gemara says someone reaches for a piece of meat, thinking that it is not kosher, and deliberately takes it and eats it, and then discovers, hey, it was kosher. Okay, I didn't do anything wrong. No, he did do something wrong, because he deliberately did something that he thought was an Avera. It was an act of rebellion, even though it ended up not actually being an Avera, but it still requires slicha, it requires forgiveness, because the person was acting deliberately to rebel against Hashem. The Gemara says similarly the flip side. A person, this is more common, a person thinks they're not doing an Avera, but they end up doing an Avera, which is a shogeg, which we would call that negligence. It's not, was not deliberate, it wasn't premeditated. Person that took a piece of meat thinking it was kosher and ate it, and it turned out it wasn't kosher. A person needs slicha, a person needs to ask forgiveness on Yom Kippur for it, because a shogeg, he actually ate not kosher, even though he didn't mean to, but unless it is an ones, unless it's something which was absolutely impossible to prevent, unless that's the case, if there's any degree of negligence there, a person would need to ask forgiveness from Hashem. Obviously, it's not a horrific Avera, because it wasn't premeditated, it wasn't on purpose, but nevertheless, it is still an Avera and needs to be dealt with. So either way, if a person thinks they're doing an Avera but really isn't, or a person thinks they're not doing an Avera but they really are, either way requires slicha, it requires forgiveness. It's a sobering Gemara, because the Gemara is pointing out that as much as we care very much about the particulars of what is going on, is it technically a mitzvah? Is it technically not a mitzvah? Is it technically an Avera? Is it technically not an Avera? We know that we have spent a lot of time figuring out those nuances and those details, and that is very, very important. But still, what a person is intending to do also matters. And if a person intends to rebel, then a person needs to deal with that. It still needs to be dealt with. Pasuk Zion verse 7. If this young lady now becomes, well, it says that she goes to a man, says here, married to a man. I wouldn't have used the word married, but we'll see exactly what it's talking about in a minute. Udareha aleha, and her oaths are upon her, which means she took an oath while she was still in her father's house, before she married, now she marries. Omiv tasfa seha, or that which uttered, was the uttered from her mouth, asher asra nafsha, that she prohibited upon herself. So, vishama isha, her husband heard about it, biyom shamo, the day he heard about it, vehechar ishan, he was quiet, vikamu nidareha, her oaths now are established, ve'esareha, and her prohibitions, asher asra nafsha, yakumu, that she prohibited upon herself, now are established. So it seems that now the power of removing the oath is no longer with her father, but rather with her husband. But that is actually making a mistake. We are going to have a case like that, but this case is not yet that case. This case is actually a case of betrothal. Kiddushin was done, but not nisuin. As you know, under a chuppah, there's two steps under a chuppah. Then in the time of the Gemara, those two steps were done a year apart. Today we do them together under the chuppah. One is the kiddushin, the betrothal, well, where he puts a ring on her finger and says, Harei at mikudeshes li. And at that point, they are legally married, but not yet allowed to live together in the same home. That requires what we call chuppah, that's nisuin, the next step, with the sheva brachos. That's what's required in order to get to the next step where they're actually going to live in the same home. So, here we are talking about between the two steps. The ring was put on her finger, but there was no chuppah yet. At that point, she is now in the domain of her father and in the domain of her husband at the same time. Therefore, both her father and her husband would have to nullify a vow in order for it to be nullified. If one did and the other one did not, it would not be nullified. And that's what it means over here, that if her husband hears about it and he is quiet, then it is established. Even if her father nullified it, it wouldn't help because here the husband established it. Pasuk Tes, verse 9. Vim biyom shemoa isha yani osa, but if when her husband hears about it, he prevents her. In other words, he removes the vow. Vehi feres nidra shehalel. He nullifies the vow that's upon her. Veiz mivtas vasela, and that which was said from her mouth. Asher asra al nafsha, that she prohibited upon herself. And the Gemara explains this means, and her father also nullifies it. Vashem yisachla, Hashem will forgive her. The vow is removed. If they both together nullify the vow. V'neidra almano grusha, but the vow of a widow or a divorcee, then she's no longer in the domain of her father, she's no longer in the domain of her husband. Therefore, kol asher asra nafsha yakum aleha, whatever she prohibits will on herself will be established. There is no one who can remove it other than, of course, the Talmud Chacham, which is universal. But the father or husband, in this case, there is no father or husband to do it. Vimbeis isha nadara, but if she takes a vow when she is fully married, she takes the vow after she's already in the house of her husband, she's fully married. Oh, asra yisara nafsha bishvua, or she prohibited something on herself using a shivua. Vishama isha, and her husband heard about it, v'hechar ishla, and he was quiet. Lo heini osa, he did not prevent her. V'kamu kol nidareha, all of her oaths will be established. V'cholisara she'asra nafsha, yakum, and all that she prohibited upon herself will be established. V'imafer yafer osam isha biyom shamo, but if the husband will nullify them on the day that he hears about them, kol motzas v'aseha, all that comes out of her mouth, lin dareha, for her vows, uli yisar nafsha, and what was prohibited upon herself, lo yakum, will not be established, isha hafeiram, her husband has nullified them, v'hashem yislachla, and Hashem will forgive her. So if she took the vow in her husband's house after she's fully married, now it is exclusively her husband's domain to nullify the vows. There is still going to be a major difference between a father nullifying vows and a husband nullifying vows, which we're about to get to. But before we do that, I want to mention to you that the nullifying of vows by a father or a husband must be done on the day that they hear about it. They have On the day they hear about it, they need to nullify the vow. So that's what we keep seeing over here, on the day that they heard about it. B'yom Shamo, the day they hear about it. A Talmud Chacham can remove a vow even if it was 10 years ago. It could be removed. But a father or a husband that's removing a vow needs to be done on the day that they hear about it. The Torah continues now in Pasuk Yudal, verse 14, to highlight a difference between a father and a husband. Kol neder v'chol shvuas isar li'anos nafesh. Any vow or any shvua that creates a prohibition, to li'anos nafesh, to afflict the soul. Isha yikimenu v'isha yifirenu. A husband can establish it, a husband can remove it. A husband can only remove or establish vows that are le'anos nefesh, inui nefesh, that afflict the soul. For example, a wife says, I take an oath that I will not eat. So that afflicts the soul. And if it afflicts the soul, a husband can remove it. But if she takes a vow that I take a shvua, that I will eat ice cream, so that doesn't afflict the soul. It may afflict the body, but it doesn't afflict the soul. So there, in that case, a husband would not be able to remove that vow. It's only something that is painful, meaning physically painful, is something he could remove. The Gemara, though, tells us there's another category that he can remove, and that is dvarim shebeino lebeina, things that are between him and her. A type of vow that will affect the two of them, that is a direct effect to their relationship, that can also be removed by the husband. So a father can remove any type of vow, but a husband can only remove that which is an inui nefesh that afflicts the soul or affects their relationship. Pasuk Tezvav, verse 15. And if the husband will be quiet from day to day, and he establishes all of her nidarim, all of her oaths, or all of the afflictions that are upon her, all of the provisions that are upon her, he established them, because he was quiet on the day that he heard about it. And if he then nullifies them after he hears about them, he will be responsible for her sin. That means the following. Let's say a husband, or a father for that matter, hears about the oath or the vow and establishes it and says, I hereby declare that I'm fully behind this oath or this vow. I support it. Well, at that point, he loses the right to remove it. Once he says that it's in force, then it's in force. And that's it. Even if it's within the same day, it doesn't matter. Once he says, I establish it, then it is established. So what happens if the father or the husband proclaims that it's established, but the wife, the daughter, doesn't know about that? Then he says in front of her, I nullify it. So she thinks it's nullified. She doesn't know. And therefore she behaves as if there's no vow. In this case, he's held responsible. This is not dissimilar to what we said before. Before the case was, she thought it was in force, but it really wasn't. And she behaved as if she was breaking the vow. So her intentions are not pure. So she needs slicha. But here, as far as she knows, it's gone. My father, my husband said, there's no vow. How is she to know that the father or the husband had already established it before? And therefore, if she transgresses, it is on his head, not on her head. He is held accountable for any transgression of the vow in this case. And finally, the Torah concludes, Pasuk Yud Zayin, verse 17, Eilach Hukim, these are the statutes Asher Tziva Hashem Es Moshe, that Hashem commanded Moshe, Bein Ish Liishto, between a husband and a wife, Bein Av Levito, between a father and his daughter, Bein Ureha, when she is a young woman, Beis Avia, while in the house of her father. Bein Ureha, Beis Avia, meaning that's the two prerequisites for a father to be able to nullify that which his daughter did. It has to be the right age, which is bin ureha. She has to be a nara, as we described before. And also it has to be while she is still living at home. If she's already left home and she's already married, which is possible, even though perhaps not recommended, but it is possible for her to be married at a younger age, then a father no longer has the ability to nullify the vows. Yeah.
What if the father had died shortly after the girl was born and she only has a mother? Does the mother have any responsibilities in that direction?
The question is, if the father has died and she only has a mother, then does the mother have any responsibilities? The answer is no, only a father. This is exclusively between a father and a daughter and between a husband and a wife. It is not, and no one else has this ability. Again, you have the universal nullification of a Talmud Chacham, but what we're talking about here is exclusively between a father and daughter and a husband and a wife. As much as culturally this doesn't jive with things that go on today, with the way people think today, but you see that the way the Torah sets things up is that a daughter is considered to be in her father's domain when she's at a young age, and a wife is considered to be in her husband's domain. You see that that is the case, the way the Torah is setting it up. This is not so between a father and a son. It is only a father and a daughter, and then a husband and a wife. You don't see it in any other way besides that, which highlights this sense of domain. When my wife was in Eretz Yisrael, and they were, when she was in seminary, and they were discussing the issue of women in the Israeli military, and why we are against that whole idea of women being in the military. One of the points that was made about that is, one of the points that was made is that the problem with the military is that it's not like a job where you can quit. A job you can always walk away from. So a woman is an employee of a male employer, and then she can always say, I'm not working for you anymore, and she can walk away. But the army does not allow that. Once you're in, you're stuck. So what that does is it creates a dynamic where a woman is under the control, could be under the control, of a man who is neither her father nor her husband. And that is unacceptable. A woman can only be, in order to prevent promiscuity, the only way that can happen is if a woman is never under the control of anybody other than her father and her husband. Once that breaks down and we allow for a system in which a woman is under the jurisdiction, the binding legal jurisdiction of a man other than a father or a husband, then we have problems either way. Either he takes advantage of her or she takes advantage of him. It goes either way because she becomes a weapon and it can go either way. Either he manipulates her or she manipulates him. But it creates a very, very bad dynamic. And that's a problem. The only other case that we have like that would be a case of slavery. But remember that the slavery that we have where a woman could be a slave, if it's a non-Jewish slave, then legally she is prohibited to the owner. So the whole dynamic there, it's enforced by the Beis Din. He's not allowed to have a relationship with her, and that is enforced by the Beis Din. If it is a Jewish slave, remember that a Jewish woman can only be a slave if she is young, not if she's already old enough for marriage. At that point, if she gets old enough for marriage, the owner, husband, whatever it is, the Adon, the master, has a choice of marrying her or letting her go free. There is no choice to keep her longer than that, because that would again create the dynamic of a man who is not a father and not a husband in control of a girl who is old enough for a relationship, and that would be unacceptable. So here, although we're not discussing relationships of that nature over here, but you see this same idea that there is an acknowledged relationship of a father to a daughter domain, a father, daughter, and husband, wife, but not any other male-female domain type relationships. That is brought out by this point over here. Yeah.
Question about if a young girl doesn't have a father, so all her nadarim, they're not established because there's no one there to hear.
Okay, so if there's, the question is, if there's no father, then what about establishing her vows? So as long as she is a ketana, she's under 11 and possibly even under 12, then the vows aren't going to be binding because she's not old enough to do it. But once she reaches that age, she will be like a 12 and a half year old.
Oh, really?
She's in her own domain. There is no one else for her to be in the domain of, therefore.
Established, right. Even though there's no father.
Okay. Right. Then it'll be established, right. Okay. Okay, so just a reminder again, next week there's no class because it is Shavuos night. So, Mirza Shem, 2 weeks.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to torahmediaatlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.